Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Oh, man. The change, it's coming too fast. I don't know if I can take it. After 121 years, the Rose Parade is changing its name. Not the one in Portland, the real one. It's part of a new sponsorship deal with Honda. Next year's Rose Parade will officially be known as the 122nd Rose Parade presented by Honda. I don't know if I can watch the Minute Maid float, the Florist Telegraph delivery float, in this new atmosphere of commercialization. Change is coming too fast. You know what I'm saying? Well, you know what I'm saying. You may not agree with it, but you know what I'm saying. This is a perhaps a new feature of the broadcast. I'm calling it Letters from the Edge. And the first one comes from Tim. Dear Harry, I just listened to last week's Le Show, and I noted with interest your story on the Stuxnet worm. They're good eating. And the fact that critical infrastructure computers run on Windows. I can assure you that oil refineries are no different. Tim continues, I travel to several refineries as part of my job, and they all use Windows. Worse yet, these Windows computers are often poorly isolated from the Internet. My supervisor and I have spent several years working on improving the security of our company's computers, but we haven't managed to get funding to complete the security upgrades at all of our facilities, and we are a fairly large organization. I can only imagine what it must be like at smaller companies, Tim continues. And then his final paragraph. The control systems vendors that sell us these computers have only recently and grudgingly embraced security as a real problem. And the solutions they come up with are not comprehensive or even effective at all in some cases. One vendor, until a recent version that just came out and is not being widely adopted because it has so many problems, forced users to use the same username and password on all their Windows computers, lest their applications all fail to start. For one Simpsons episode paycheck, I can send you that username and password. Sincerely, Tim. Letters from the Edge, ladies and gentlemen. Just to let you know, security is our... Which number job is it again? I forget. News of AFPAC. Whom do we need, ladies and gentlemen? Who on the list of nations in the world you think we would be turning to now for help in the whole Afghanistan war? I mean, the Dutch are leaving. The Australians, don't really know. Who can you turn to, as the song so ungrammatically put it? How about Bangladesh? Sure, the U.S. wants Bangladesh to deploy its troops in Afghanistan to establish security and stability. Bangladesh said it would do whatever it can do to help restore peace in South Asia, especially in Afghanistan. The subject was discussed when our U.S. Special Representative for AFPAC, Richard Holbrooke, met the foreign minister of Bangladesh. Extra points if you can name the foreign minister of Bangladesh, Dipu Moni, in New York. He sought, quote, any kind of help, like deploying combat troops, unquote, providing economic development assistance. Economic assistance from Bangladesh, ladies and gentlemen, think of it. I've heard of begging. I've heard of homeless people in cardboard boxes, but this, and training for the law enforcement agencies. That's right. Bangladesh can train law enforcement in Afghanistan. I know it sounds kooky. Dipu Moni assured Holbrooke that Bangladesh would do whatever it can. It has already offered to send teachers and doctors to Afghanistan. A similar request for Bangladeshi troops was made during the Bush years for deployment in Iraq, according to a Bangladeshi newspaper. We don't know whether the Bangladeshis were part of the coalition of the... And, other news of AFPAC, don't be number three. I've told you this before, ladies and gentlemen. One thing you don't want to be in, if you're thinking of going to... If Al-Qaeda is recruiting you, if you're on a college campus right now and you went to the Al-Qaeda booth and they said good job opportunities in Al-Qaeda, the number three slot, for example, don't take that. Al-Qaeda's operational chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan was killed this week in a U.S. drone strike in Pakistan's tribal areas Sheikh Fateh had reportedly been given the job in May after al-Qaeda's purported number three, Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, was killed. So he lasted as number three for 4 months. Yes, he has been killed, one Pakistani security official. Locally, he was known as Abdul Razak. But by locally, we don't mean here. So whatever job they offer you, say, I'm not telling you what to do with your life, but I'm just saying, don't be number three. Ladies and gentlemen, just, you know, every once in a while, I love to call attention to the contrast between our brothers and sisters in the United Kingdom and those of us here in the former colonies. And one this week really, really puts it in sharp focus. You know that the epithet that has been used most consistently by conservative opponents of President Obama, aside from socialist and Muslim, has been radical. It's radical. This is the most radical administration in history, they love to say, ignoring some of the facts. Now, over in England, there's a conservative government. It's a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, but it's still a conservative government. And the conservative prime minister, in the wake of the announcement of, in the anticipation of the announcement of widespread spending cuts to deal with their deficit, because that's what they're doing, because they're conservatives, uses one word to describe the changes that he's proposing to make in British government. Radical. He's prideful about how radical he is. See the difference? And they also, to turn their lights on, they turn the switch down. That I'll never understand, but radical. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not ending the show, but in this opening segment before I finally get to some music. Finally, if Rick Sanchez is right about who owns the media, then Rupert Murdoch is very, very late for his bar mitzvah. Hello, welcome to the show. And for his bris, I got the equipment in my car. Well, no, it doesn't rust at the beach. What do you mean? Oh, you must have put a boot on me. Oh, you must have cast a spell. The way I'm loving you, girl, ain't no tongue can tell. Oh, you must have been burning candles. Oh, to make a love so strong. You must have sprinkled dust all around my bed. You must have had a black cat bone. We'll be right back. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Even as the U.S. Postal Service began sliding into the worst financial crisis in its history, some postal executives in recent years have found a way to earn more money by resigning from their jobs with the Postal Service and returning as highly paid contractors while doing essentially the same work. In three recent contracts awarded without competitive bidding, don't you know, former Postal Service executives were hired to perform what contracting records described as knowledge transfer. According to a review of the operation by the Post Office's Office of Inspector General, these contracts were put in place even though highly experienced postal executives filled the positions vacated by the former executives. One former vice president retired in May and within 2 months received a $260,000 no-bid knowledge transfer contract for the postal executive who assumed his old job. Overall, the Inspector General's office found 17 no-bid contracts awarded to former postal executives within a year of their retirement dates. Talk about return to sender. Citing three of the contracts, the report found the rate was $75 an hour for one former executive, $160 an hour for two others. Wow. And he doesn't even have to go to shrink school. Such contracting practices raise serious ethics concerns, the Inspector General's office warned in the report. Quote, it appears unethical to hire back former executives at nearly twice their former pay to advise new executives who were placed in their position based on their expertise and years of Postal Service experience. There is also employee morale and public image issues management must consider. Yeah, there is issues. Nobody said the Inspector General's office was grammatical. Must consider when the Postal Service is closing post offices and seeking a reduced delivery schedule. A U.S. government executive investigation has uncovered evidence of widespread cheating by FBI agents in an internal exam. And J. Edgar Hoover is rolling over in his caftan. The exam was designed to test their knowledge of terrorism investigations and foreign intelligence gathering. The Department of Justice found that FBI field agents had cheated by conferring and using crib sheets and computers to look up answers.
Well, why'd they give us computers if they didn't want us to look up the answers?
The report found a significant number of FBI employees engaged in some form of improper conduct or cheating on the test. Suspicions were raised after 200 FBI staff completed the 90-minute exam in less than 20 minutes. What the? All employees were retired to take the 51-question exam after undergoing 16 and a half hours of tuition about controversial new guidelines for domestic terrorism investigations. After interviewing staff, investigators found many people taking the exam had conferred, workers in one office exploited a programming flaw to call up the answers, and in another office, of 11 workers interviewed, three supervisors and four agents said they'd used answer sheets. Some tried to justify the usage on the basis that these were notes. The Office of the Department of Justice Inspector General recommended that those who directly cheated should be disciplined. And they called for a wider investigation. We believe there was more cheating and improper conduct than we had identified through our limited interviews. The FBI director expressed disappointment at his employees' conduct. Disappointment. And vowed to investigate the scale of the cheating and take appropriate action by issuing a statement of disappointment. Or maybe a declaration of disappointment. More from the Inspector General, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA to you and me, has a mixed environmental record, earning only a fair rating from the Inspector General of itself. Despite ongoing improvements in air quality and new efforts to improve coal ash disposal, TVA Inspector General Richard Moore says TVA's coal ash spill in Kingston, Tennessee, nearly 2 years ago, represented one of the largest environmental disasters in U.S. history and demonstrated poor performance in managing coal ash. By the TVA. Hey, that's like herding cats, managing coal ash. Every piece of it wants to go somewhere else. The federal utility also has one of the highest concentrations of transformers with toxic PCBs, which new rules may require to be replaced. Moore says TVA also continues to trail many other utilities in renewable energy. And we own it. You plus me equals Yume. Deadline Charleston, West Virginia. Regulators from both political parties have, for more than three decades, failed to strongly and properly enforce their legal authority to crack down on coal mine operators who repeatedly violate health and safety laws. That's according to the Department of Labor's Inspector General. Mine Safety and Health Administration stalled implementation of its pattern of violations authority, taking 13 years from the passage of the law to finalize the regulations that actually will give it that authority. Well, you know, regulations. Where does the period go? Before or after the end of the sentence? The Mining Safety and Health Administration then undercut its own authority with weak regulations, failed to adequately monitor operators it had warned had repeated safety problems, and issued error-prone computer systems to keep track of potential renegade mining operations, according to the IG. Government and computers. Something's wrong there. The IRS, the Pentagon, the Mine Health Administration. Are they using Windows? Is that the deal? News of the Inspector General. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim, let me know. News of the Inspector General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and now it's clean, it's cheap, it's too safe to meter. It's nuclear power. It's our friend, the Atom. Hey, Addy.
Hello.
There he is, right over there. Where are you going?
I'm splitting.
He's splitting. The Atom is splitting. Deadline Karachi. China, whose support of Pakistan's nuclear power industry has raised concern in the West. Sure, why shouldn't Pakistan have nuclear power? It already has nuclear weapons, you see. They're going the other way. China reportedly plans to build a nuclear plant that will be bigger than two already fully or nearly completed, according to the Asia Times. That's good news. What could go wrong there? Meanwhile, government authorities, government subsidies of nuclear power plants could hitch U.S. taxpayers to a technology that suffers out-of-control costs, while pushing aside renewable energy, according to a study released recently by the Vermont Law School's Institute for Energy and the Environment. Looks at the nuclear industry in France, does this study, where an aggressive nuclear program has resulted in three-quarters of the country's power coming from nuke, as we've been told. But it says what has been hailed as a nuclear miracle in France should serve as a cautionary tale. Quote, this analysis shows the greatest danger is not that the U.S. will import French technology, but it will replicate the French model of nuclear socialism. Ooh, he used the S word, did Mark Cooper, the report's author. Nuclear power will remain a ward of the state as it has been throughout its history in France. I think he hit the magic button there. S the magic button. The 2005 Energy Policy Act gives the Department of Energy authority to disburse $18.5 billion in loan guarantees. Eight and a half of it will go to a proposed nuclear plant in Georgia being built by Southern Company. And the Obama administration is asking for an additional $36 billion for loan guarantees. Such guarantees would be a raw deal for taxpayers, according to the study. It's highly unlikely that the problems of reactor construction will be solved by an infusion of federal loan guarantees, Cooper says. U.S. policymakers should resist efforts to force the government into making large loans in terms that put taxpayers at risk in order to save a project or industry that may not, or industry that may not be salvageable. Specifically, the report says the nuclear industries in U.S. and France have seen sharp cost escalations. Measured in 2008 dollars, the cost of a nuclear power plant, excluding interest, was about $1,000 per kilowatt in the early 70s. 20 years later, U.S. costs are now up to between $5,000 and $6,000 per kilowatt. French costs are at $5,000. Oh, it's cheap. The former geological surveyor for the controversial nuclear waste depot in Germany, Gorleben, has warned that there could be dangerous gas deposits lurking beneath the old salt dome caverns. Quote, it is totally incomprehensible to me that despite all of these deficiencies, Gorleben is still being examined for its suitability as a storage facility, geologist Klaus Dufporn said. According to him, there would have to be no gas above a depth of 1,500 meters in the Salt Dome. But this can't be confirmed. East German files from 1969, when the communist regime drilled into the Salt Dome, show there was a deadly accident involving a gas explosion just 5 kilometers from where the nuclear waste is located. That incident proves there are 2 geological layers under the mine that hold natural gas, Duporn said. This gas is highly explosive. The ignition point is at 20 degrees Celsius. It's about 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, if it meets oxygen. Other geological deficiencies mean that caverns could shift, creating cracks that might allow for the contamination of groundwater, he said. He was the first official geologist hired by the German government to survey Gorleben.
Dave Gorleben comes to the plate.
His opinion, however, was later kept out of the official appraisal, he said, alleging this was because of his unfavorable conclusions.
Well, it's safe.
It's cheap and it's safe. British nuclear decommissioning will cost their Department of Energy and Climate around $2.5 billion, half of the department's overall budget, as it works to clean up matters that, according to the new climate and energy secretary, should have been dealt with in the past. Sorting this problem out now is much more expensive than if it had been dealt with before, Chris Hume added. The government, he says, will learn from this. Want to bet? And emptying, cleaning, and sealing 22 underground nuclear waste storage tanks at the Savannah River nuclear site will cost substantially more and take longer than previously thought, according to a new report. The final cost will be about $4.5 billion, nearly 50% more than the $3.2 billion specified in a contract just 2 years ago between the Energy Department and Savannah River Remediation. This according to the Government Accountability Office. They mostly blamed the Energy Department, saying the agency used flawed cost estimates when soliciting bids. Also, about $500 million of the cost increase has little to do with actual cleanup. It has to do with pensions. It's clean, it's cheap, it's safe. Addie Split. We can't hear from him again. It's nuclear power, ladies and gentlemen. And just to keep up with our friends at the United States Army Corps of Engineers, because they are the best. They're the best Army Corps of Engineers we got. Ignoring calls to scrutinize troubled contractors, the U.S. military has awarded a portion of a $500 million contract to an American corporation that's under investigation for possible fraud. What part of the military? The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers awarded the contract to Lewis Berger Group, a New Jersey-based company that federal prosecutors acknowledge is being investigated for allegedly overbilling the government.
Yeah. I'm sorry, that was Lenny.
The contract sounded like Lenny. It wasn't Lenny. Lenny's not here. The contract will be shared and is providing for providing generators, building power plants, and installing high-voltage transmission systems in conflict and disaster response locations around the world. The decision to continue doing business with Lewis Berger has fueled criticism, according to McClatchy newspapers, that the Obama administration is willing to overlook criminal allegations in its zeal to rebuild Afghanistan and Iraq. Lewis Berger is handling some of the most important U.S. projects in Afghanistan. The overbilling allegations arise from a whistleblower lawsuit that accused Lewis Berger of manipulating overhead cost data and overhead rate proposals submitted to the U.S. government and several states. But it's just money. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, you see what I'm saying. Court documents reveal the Justice Department is negotiating a deal that could aid in preserving the company's continuing eligibility to participate. Lewis Berger officials have declined to respond to questions about the investigation, but they say it shouldn't taint their work for the government. That much they're willing to say. Just enough comment. One of their projects is $40 million over budget and a year behind schedule. A power plant in Kabul, told you about it a few weeks ago from the Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. He questions the wisdom of building that diesel and heavy fuel plant because the Afghan government may not have the capacity to sustain it. Well, I'm turning it into a theme restaurant. Power. You know, theme restaurant with a kind of kooky name like that. Power. And repairs to the Santa Maria River, just north of here in California, sorry, not to the river, to the levee, remain on schedule. Hey, that's good news from the Army Corps of Engineers. Construction work is supposed to be concluded by December. Work is progressing very well, says a Corps spokesman. Brooks Hubbard IV. Fixes to the flawed structure. Flawed? Are needed to ensure that the rain-swollen Santa Maria River does not flood nearby urban areas and farmland. The levee was built between 1959 and 1963 by the Corps. That was the magical time for the Corps. But the maintenance has been the responsibility of Santa Barbara County. County officials say the levee has deteriorated because of inadequate design by the Corps, not lack of maintenance. Where have we heard, That's right. In the Big Uneasy, which you can't see now, but it'll be at the New Orleans Film Festival and the St. Louis Film Festival. And for information, just go to thebiguneasy.com. Faulty design. Gee, they should. I'm sure they're very ashamed.
Yourself.
This is Le Show from the world headquarters of Le Show, the Santa Monica Le Show Dome. And ladies and gentlemen, this is the Unsurge. And the Unsurge is working too. Hundreds of police officers, formerly members of an American-backed Sunni paramilitary force, are being stripped of their ranks in the Sunni Arab province of Anbar. We now learn, according to the Washington Post, the officers called the move by Iraq's Interior Ministry, which oversees police, a threat to security in Anbar, once a stronghold of Sunni insurgent violence. In 2006, a group called the Awakening, former insurgents, rose up with tribal and U.S. backing, i.e. money, to battle al-Qaeda in Iraq. What became the Sons of Iraq is credited with helping to calm Sunni Arab areas. In 2007, the U.S. military transformed many of the Awakening members in Anbar into police officers, paying them, and then turning them over to the Iraqi government, expecting them to continue to be paid. Now, many, such as these 410 men in Anbar, are being stripped of their ranks, targeted by al-Qaeda in Iraq, or think the Shiite-led government is trying to get rid of them. This committee in the Ministry of Interior is sectarian, says Ahmed Abu Risha, head of the Awakening, who's now head of the Asleepening. When you dismiss those who fought al-Qaeda in the streets, this is support for al-Qaeda. What I expect are dire consequences. Unquote. Tribal leaders and police officers in Anbar warned that the move could destabilize the province. A group of officers demanded that Prime Minister Maliki rescind the order, calling it a, quote, gift offered by the government on a gold platter, unquote, to al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Unsurge, ladies and gentlemen. And you may have noted over the weekend that the seven-month-long stalemate in following up the election with the choosing of an actual government in Iraq may have been solved by the Maliki administration, the Maliki gang making a deal with the people who were shooting at us in 2006 and 7, and we were shooting at them. That would be Muqtada al-Sadr's group. Sadr, we, I believe, helped kick him out of Iraq, and guess where he is now? Guess where he is where he called for this deal with Maliki, whom he opposed till recently. He's in Iran, ladies and gentlemen. You figure it out. And in Baghdad, as the military prepares to leave Iraq, Iraqis are still asking, whatever happened to the electricity? In 2003, they heard President Bush promise, we will help them to restore basic services such as electricity. 7 years later, the state's inability to provide reliable power to homes remains one of the most striking signs of the dysfunction that persists in Iraq, according also to the Washington Post. In the absence of dependable central power, generators from small gasoline-powered models to diesel-driven giants that fuel a neighborhood churn around the clock in Baghdad and across the country. The hum is everywhere, a constant auditory reminder of an unfulfilled American promise. The power shortages have resulted from corruption, failed development policies, insurgent attacks on installations, and a government paralyzed by sectarian political infighting. Iraq's electricity minister was forced to resign in June after deadly protests against shortages erupted across the country. But that didn't turn the lights on. So, you know, job well done. In the new Iraq. Unsurging as we speak. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline New Delhi, the U.S. Homeland Security Department has apologized to India's Civil Aviation Minister Praful Patel, who was stopped and questioned by the immigration authorities at Chicago's O'Hare Airport due to an identity mix-up. Patel's name and birth date matched that of a person on the U.S. terrorist watch list. He later flew to Montreal to get out of the United States. Are you ready for some football apologies? Green Bay Packers safety Nick Collins has apologized for an altercation with a fan after Monday night's loss to the Bears. Collins tossed his mouth guard at a fan after Green Bay's 20-17 loss as the team went tunnel toward the locker room. Collins was provoked by a fan who called him a racial epithet. Collins apologized to his team and his fans on Wednesday for drawing negative attention to the Packers. "This is a situation I know I could have walked away from, but, you know, heat of the moment, things happen. Both sides were out of line." Unquote. Oh, we have a hockey apology, too. Chicago Blackhawks defenseman Nick Boynton apologized for a throat-slashing gesture he made toward Tampa Bay Lightning center Blair Jones that cost him a one-game suspension. Happened during the Blackhawks preseason opener Wednesday in Winnipeg. "It was just stupid," he said. "I was upset. He beat me up, whatever. It was a stupid play on my part, and I'm paying for it. It sucks, but I made my bed. Now I have to sleep in it. It's unfortunate, but that stuff happens." The suspension cost him $2,600 going to the player's emergency fund. "I've been around," Boynton said. "I know better. It hurts the team, keeps me out of a game, and looks bad for the organization. I've apologized to who I have to apologize to, and it won't happen again." The NFL had sent out a video to all teams illustrating behavior that will not be tolerated, including the throat slash gesture. So it wasn't spontaneous. Maybe he got the idea from the video. Dalen Harrisburg, Pennsylvania's Homeland Security Director, testified before a legislative committee this week to explain why information about citizen activists was shared with natural gas drillers by government contractor. Homeland Security Director James Powers told the Senate Military and Veterans Affairs Committee he sincerely apologized if state residents included in the bulletins compiled by the Institute of Terrorism Research felt as if their constitutional rights had been infringed upon. That's two ifs. That's a two-if apology there, baby. That's too subjunctive for me. He did say the state did not ask for or receive lists of individuals or groups. "We do not maintain a list of either." Deadline Australia, Sir Richard Branson has formally apologized for his airline down there, Virgin Blue's, recent technical troubles in an effort to appease customers who've been affected by delays. "It's been a terrible 24 hours with the computer system going down," he told Channel 7. Virgin Blue staff nationwide were forced to process customers by hand. Ow, that's gotta hurt. Following the collapse of the carrier's computer check-in system, led to a number of cancellations and stranded passengers. The owner of one of Utah's largest construction companies engaged in an improper relationship with the State Department of Transportation manager. The agency has already been under scrutiny for its contracting, huge settlement payments, and political surprises. Guy Wadsworth, founder and president of Wadsworth Brothers Construction, apologized for the embarrassment his extramarital relationship with the employee caused to his family and his business partners. But he denied it played any role in UDOT's decision to award a group of companies that include his a billion-dollar contract to rebuild Interstate 15 in Utah County. But apparently he was out hiking Interstate 15. Perv, where's Perv been? Perv is back. Pervez Musharraf, the Army general who was Pakistan's military ruler for 9 years, apologized to the nation for past mistakes this week as he launches a new political party preparing to make fresh mistakes. No, sorry. The All-Pakistan Muslim League, Musharraf says, has attracted about 300,000 followers on Facebook. Or maybe it's just in the movie. They will wage a jihad against illiteracy and hunger, says Perv. That's like the war on drugs. You got to wage a jihad on something. Jeremy Ben-Ami, the founder and director of J Street, the liberal Jewish lobbying group in Washington, has apologized to followers for misleading them about George Soros' role in funding the pro-Israel group. Quote, "I accept responsibility personally for being less than clear about Mr. Soros' support once he did become a donor," Ben-Ami said on the J Street website. "I said Mr. Soros did not help launch J Street or provide its initial funding, and that is true. I also said we would be happy to take his support, but I did not go the extra step to add that he did, in fact, start providing support 6 months after our launch. It does not have a tax-exempt status, so J Street is under no obligation to reveal its donors." The White House apologized this week to the family of a Medal of Honor recipient who was turned away from a tour of the West Wing last weekend because the late veteran's 10-year-old grandson was wearing shorts. Ladies and gentlemen, shorts. Kid was wearing shorts. Vernon Baker was the last surviving black Medal of Honor winner from World War II. He was belatedly awarded the honor in 1997 by President Clinton after historians concluded he'd been snubbed from receiving the award because of race. He died in July after complications from brain cancer. He was buried last Friday at Arlington. On Saturday, his widow and grandson, along with another Medal of Honor winner, arrived at the White House for an exclusive tour of the West Wing. But the three were turned away after a White House staffer who was to lead the tour wasn't sure the grandson's attire was appropriate. Vernon was wearing shorts and a T-shirt with a photo of his late grandfather on the front. The White House has apologized. And exposing a dark page in its history, the United States government acknowledged this week that government scientists had infected some 1,500 Guatemalans with syphilis and gonorrhea in experiments from 1946 to 1948 in, quote, appalling violations, unquote, of medical ethics. U.S. scientists infected prostitutes with syphilis or gonorrhea and sent them to have unprotected sex with soldiers or prison inmates, later testing them for possible cures. When few became infected, scientists turned to patients at a mental health hospital, exposing them to infection by rubbing it doesn't say what the it is here in this story, rubbing it on their genitals. None of the subjects was informed about the study or offered consent. At least one patient is known to have died, says Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Health and Human Secretary Kathleen Sebelius in a joint statement. These events occurred more than 64 years ago. We are outraged that such reprehensible research could have occurred under the guise of public health. We deeply regret that it happened, and we apologize to all the individuals who were affected by such abhorrent research practices. Current regulations prohibit such appalling violations of ethics, they said. Clinton called the president of Guatemala to express her personal outrage and deep regret. And the president of Guatemala voiced anger. These should be considered crimes against humanity, and Guatemala reserves the right to petition the relevant international court at an opportune time. Oh, now that's so unnecessary. You got a call from Hillary Clinton. Why would you want to do that? The acknowledgment said new light on U.S. medical experiments that included the infamous Tuskegee study in which scientists observed but didn't treat hundreds of African-American men with late-stage syphilis in Macon County, Alabama, over 40 years. A Wellesley College professor of history discovered evidence of the secret U.S. test in Guatemala while examining Tuskegee papers. I was very shocked when I saw all this, she said. Whoever knew about it was long dead. Physician who led the U.S. Public Health Service team was John C. Cutler. You could go put flowers on his grave. Johnson & Johnson hired contract workers in the spring of 2009 to buy thousands of bottles of Motrin instead of issuing a recall of the defective product, an action for which the company's chief executive has apologized. There's absolutely no doubt we let customers down, said CEO William Weldon. This was not one of our finer moments. Compared to the invention of the Band-Aid, sir, I guess you're right. Southern Poverty Law Center has apologized to historian Gunter Louis for suggesting he was a Turkish agent due to his stance regarding the Armenian allegations on the incidents of 1915. It says it now misunderstood Professor Louis' scholarship was wrong to assert he was part of a network financed by the Turkish government. It was wrong to assume that any scholar who challenges the Armenian genocide narrative necessarily has been compromised by the government of Turkey. Louis said the SPLC's apology cleared his reputation and constituted a victory for free research. Chad Ochocinco, you ready for another football apology? He was trying to do a good deed by raising money for Feed the Children with his cereal Ochocinco's, but he and fellow givers were in for a surprise. On Ochocinco's boxes, the Feed the Children telephone number was incorrect. It was the number to an adult hotline. The cereal has been pulled from supermarket shelves until the problem is fixed. Ochocinco apologized via Twitter, saying, "Oh, man, I'm bummed about the serial number mix-up on the serial. Trying to do good and got messed up of all numbers. Why that one? Sorry." Deadline Washington Senator Saxby Chambliss formally apologized to the gay community for an internet slur that came from a staffer in his office declaring that all gays must die. He says he's removed the employee behind the remark. "I'm sorry for the hurt this incident has caused. Such comments are simply unacceptable and not befitting those who work in the U.S. Senate." His office declined to identify who wrote the message. Pacific Gas and Electric companies apologized to East Palo Alto leaders for failing to notify them that a gas pipeline in the city was on a list of 100 high-risk pipelines. Five PG&E representatives showed up at the city council meeting to apologize. PG had reached out to other cities on its list of the top 100 high-risk pipelines. East Palo Alto was ignored. Meg Whitman, candidate for governor of California, apologized to everyone in California for not voting. It was not the right thing to do, and no one is more embarrassed by it than me, and if I could change history, I would, she said. But what I can do is make you vote for me. A prominent Mormon elder was moved to tears as he listened to the stories of several lesbian and gay Mormons who described at a recent Oakland, California meeting how hurt they'd been by the church's involvement in the Proposition 8 campaign to abolish gay marriage. The meeting ended with tears and an apology from Elder Marlon K. Jensen, the official historian of the Mormon Church. To the full extent of my capacity, I say that I am sorry. I know that many very good people have been deeply hurt, and I know that the Lord expects better of us, he said. The United States apologized this week for displaying the Philippine flag upside down at a meeting in New York, attended by President Obama, describing it as an honest mistake. How are you supposed to know? How can you tell? I guess they know. An American embassy spokesperson in Manila said it was an honest mistake, and the U.S. treasured its close relationship with the Philippines. And the flag was wearing shorts, which made it even. And Dateline Cairo, Egypt's Coptic Christian leader, Pope Shenouda III. They got a pope. Did you know that? They got a pope. Everybody got a pope these days. Egypt's Coptic Christian leader, Pope Shenouda III, apologized in a television interview last week to any Muslims who were offended after his top bishop reputedly disputed the authenticity of some verses of the Quran. Uh-oh. There's heightened tension right now in Egypt between majority Muslims and the Christian minority that feels discriminated against. Hey, Rick Sanchez, you could go there. Shenouda's apology comes a day after the premier Institute of Islamic Learning in the Sunni Muslim world criticized Bishop Bishoy, the Coptic Church's number two, for provoking sectarian tension. Bishop Bishoy. I gotta read up on the Coptic Church. They got a pope. Well, I'm going to get a pope. What do you say? The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
He's a mood swinging man with a bag of tricks. Never know where he's at. The life of the party when he's doing his flips. The drag when he's flat on his back. This town feels empty when he's gone away. Something new to discover every day. The wheels in his hand, he takes me up. He brings me back down again. Flash in the pan, mood swinging man can pretend. He'll be back.
lights up. He's a flash in the pan. No swinging man. No idea who I am. I'm a mood swinging man.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. This from The Independent in London. British scientific experts have made a major breakthrough in the fight to save the natural world from destruction, leading to an international effort to safeguard a global system worth at least $5 trillion a year to mankind and womankind. Groundbreaking new research by a former banker, Pavan Sukhdev, to place a price tag on the worldwide network of environmental assets has triggered an international race to halt the destruction of rainforests, wetlands, and coral reefs. Experts are warning the battle to stem the loss of biodiversity is two decades behind the climate change agenda. The UK government is championing a new system to identify the financial value of natural resources and the potential hit to national economies if they are lost. The Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity Project, TEEB, has begun to calculate the global economic costs of biodiversity loss. Initial results paint a startling picture. The loss of biodiversity through deforestation alone will cost the global economy up to $4.5 trillion each year, $650 for every person on the planet. Cash a check, please. And just a fraction of the total damage being wrought by overdevelopment, intensive farming, and climate change. The annual economic value of the wetlands worldwide is said to total $3.5 billion. In the pharmaceutical trade, up to 50% of all the $640 billion market comes from genetic resources. Anti-cancer agents from marine organisms alone are valued up to $1 billion a year. Last week, a study by the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew and the Natural History Museum in London suggested more than a fifth of the world's plant species are threatened with extinction. The coalition hopes that linking the disappearance of biodiversity to a threat to the economy will act as a wake-up call. Money, darling. That's what we pay attention to. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. By the way, if you're wondering if there's formaldehyde in the hair straightening product Brazilian Blowout, yes, there is. Oregon Health and Science Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology found the products contained high levels of formaldehyde, even on the bottles labeled formaldehyde-free. Well, that just meant it was free. No extra charge for the formaldehyde, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the way we all should be, don't you think? That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time Over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Hope you're not too near that nuclear waste site, folks. Around the world by the American Forces Network. Did I say that already? Around the world via computer and the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like nuclear power being clean, Chief, and too safe to meter if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. And leave us not forget a tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, yours to enjoy or to ignore, at harryshearer.com. And news about the Big Uneasy at thebiguneasy.com. How'd they figure that out? And this program is on Twitter at TheHarryShearer. Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.